ILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Reverend Reggie Weaver, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago. We're talking to him by phone. Welcome, Reverend Weaver. Good to have you on the program.
It's good to be on.
Well, we're hearing you just fine. I'm always glad when telephone connections work.
Likewise.
Your church has a fascinating history. It's one of the earliest churches, if not the earliest church, to be begun in Chicago. Tell us a little bit about some of the history. Of course, we don't have time for all of it.
Right. Okay, so yeah, we were founded in 1833, and as you said, we are one of the earliest. There are members who claim that we are the earliest, but we are fighting for that distinction with at least three other churches. We were founded in Fort Dearborn, which was kind of the original site of the city of Chicago, and there was one meeting house there for worship that several denominations shared. And so we started out as a very small Congregationalist church in that space. Eventually that congregation grew and decided to set out on its own charter, and in the process hired a Presbyterian pastor by the name of Jeremiah Porter. And so that's how we actually became a Presbyterian church. Jeremiah in particular was very, I think, a prophetic kind of figure, very, very fiery and energetic pastor, and was very concerned around various social issues. So part of the early history of our church was that we were very involved in the abolitionist movement. Some of our members were on the forefront of that. And as a reflection of that, people like Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, and other abolitionists would speak at our church regularly as part of that. Fast forward into the 1920s, a lot of our members were very involved in the women's suffrage movement. Into the 50s and 60s, very active in the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King Jr. actually spoke at our congregation on the occasion of our 125th anniversary. And so we carry forward just a very, very proud history of social activism, and one that we are really kind of still wrestling with and how we live that out nowadays.
And in terms of the history of the church in relation to race, since we're talking today about the church being a multicultural, multiracial congregation, tell us a little bit about the class and wealth and poverty of the neighborhood in which this church has found itself over these last many years.
Okay. So, yeah, so I will backtrack just a little bit and say that. So we're founded in 1833. We're currently in the Woodlawn community, which is on the south side of Chicago. And this is our sixth location in that nearly 180-year history.
Uh-huh.
We've been here since the 1920s. I believe 1925 was when we officially moved here.
And that's south of Hyde Park, south of University of Chicago.
Exactly.
63rd Street.
Right, 64th and Kimbark.
64th, I'm sorry, 64th and Kimbark.
So we're, and so when the congregation moved here, the neighborhood, like the congregation at that time, was a predominantly white community. In the late 40s, early 50s, as was happening in many places around the nation, restrictive covenants were being lifted throughout the city, which, among other things, enabled African Americans to move into communities that they had previously been restricted from. And so part of what that meant was, I think, that the congregation, both because of its own kind of progressive sensibilities, but also just recognizing that some changes were coming to the neighborhood, the congregation officially embraced in the mid-1950s at least an integrated identity. One of the classic sermons of one of my predecessors here is that God is colorblind and this will become an integrated church. And so the church did that.
And that was in the 1950s, very early.
Very early. So
in the civil rights awareness.
Exactly. Sure. So So what that did then was begin a trend so that by the mid-60s, early 70s, we were a solidly integrated church, about 50-50 black-white membership. Meanwhile, some other things were happening in the community, partly as a result of the lifting of restrictive covenants. You start to see things where some neighbors are moving out of the community. You know, we've heard about white flight in different places. Some of that was happening here in the community. So you had people leaving, and then the patterns of the city in terms of the allocation of resources began to shift with that. So a lot of funding and resources and public services were beginning to be diverted northward. So what that meant for our community was that over time, what was once a vibrant community really declined, like a lot of Southside communities. And so from that period, from the mid-60s into the 90s, and you know, really maybe even into the early 2000s, there was just this period of decline that has started to turn around of late, but is still present with us. So we find ourselves now in a community that is economically depleted, but again, starting to rebuild. We were seeing new housing coming in, the business infrastructure starting to come back. But in the course of that period, what the church did, a lot of churches in that situation made the decision to leave those neighborhoods. Our church made a decision to stay here. Because we had developed a very strong ministry with and for the poor here. And so it's a church that historically has really been comprised of middle class and wealthy folks, really of all races. But I think as we've tried to wrestle and live into this multicultural identity, we're also realizing the ways that that class and economics play into that as well, and it's not just about race. And so we've worked hard to really be a place where all people are welcome.
There was a time when the Gold Coast in Chicago was not on the north side but was on the south side, and it was during that period that your very grand building was built. That's so beautiful and has served its various purposes so well over the years.
Yes.
But of course, as the neighborhood changed, then rocks started getting thrown through windows or bullets, and of course, a building takes a beating.
Yes. We are, so you know, as you point out, our building reflects some of the changes and scars of the community. We do indeed have places. We have beautiful stained glass throughout our sanctuary. And there are those places where we've got, you know, bullet holes and rocks that have come through. And you know, it's interesting. When I first arrived here, I started here in October of 2009. And so as some of the members were kind of telling me the story and the history, there is kind of a sense of, you know, of loss and lament about, you know, some of the things that we have been through as a congregation. But at the same time, it's interesting to kind of look at some of, you know, what I call the scars of the building, and it's a testament, I think, to really what we have been through, and to our own tenacity as a congregation. And so, you know, while we are having those conversations about making certain repairs, you know, I think there's also an appreciation for the fact that some of those things are still there. It's just as a reminder of what we've come through.
And the other thing one sees just in the physical property is what you've been able to do in reaching out to the neighborhood in
right.
terms of feeding programs and education programs and in fact, gardens for people to come and grow things in. So the church really has been a good neighbor in Woodlawn on the south side of Chicago. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're about 10 minutes into our Keeping the Faith program. Reggie Weaver is the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Chicago on the corner of 64th and Kimbark in Woodlawn, south of the University of Chicago and Hyde Park. Reggie, let's hear a little bit about your background. I know you've been in Indianapolis before coming to Chicago, and I believe I remember you went to seminary. Was that in Georgia?
In Georgia, yeah. So I'm a native Southerner. I'm from Mobile, Alabama, right on the Gulf Coast. And so when people kind of ask me about that journey from Mobile to Chicago, you know, I just say I must have been looking to go from one end of I-65 to the other. But born and raised Mobile, Alabama, I went to college in Memphis, Tennessee, at Rhodes College there.
Oh, wonderful college, yes.
And I loved my time there. Small liberal arts college. I'm affiliated with our denomination. I graduated college in 2002, and in terms of the next steps and call to ministry, I think I really began to take seriously a call to ministry at that time. I was growing up, I was always very active in the church. My roots are actually in the Black Baptist tradition, and that's, you know, most of my extended family, Baptist, Pentecostal, AME. My family left that particular congregation for reasons that I don't really know. I think there were just some difficulties happening in that particular congregation. We went church shopping and landed at a Presbyterian church, and happened to land at a church that really strongly encouraged and supported youth to be very involved in various leadership roles. So
this was in Mobile?
This was in Mobile, yeah. So I had the opportunity to really, you know, just be very hands-on about the ministry and leadership in church. And so part of what happens when that's the case is that you grow up with people kind of telling you that you need to consider ministry. And I think growing up, if I'm honest about it, I was probably always considering it, but never really embraced it. But one of the things that kind of led me to think about it more seriously was when I was in college, I was a political science major. I was in and was studying politics around the time of the 2000 presidential election, and in that election in particular, Christianity and faith were a big part of the conversation, and as I was hearing it, I was realizing that the discourse didn't reflect what I really thought and felt. So it led to a period of questioning for me about what my faith, and particularly what my theological tradition had to say about it. So by the time I graduated, I wanted to explore those questions. So I took some time to really figure out what the next step would be, worked in Louisville, Kentucky, at the national headquarters for our denomination for a year of discernment, and then came out of that year saying, I feel called to seminary. And was really, the appeal to seminary for me was exactly what I said, just as a way of answering questions. I wasn't really totally committed to going into ministry at that point, but the sense of call evolved while I was there. So as you said, I went to a seminary in Atlanta, Georgia, Columbia Theological Seminary, graduated there in 2007, and because that really was a period of questioning for me, I wanted, after seminary, to spend some time working with pastors and people who have been doing ministry for a while, and there is this wonderful program called the Transition into Ministry Program, which is sponsored by the Lilly Foundation.
Out of Indianapolis, yes.
And they've got various sites around the country, and one of the sites is Second Presbyterian Church of Indianapolis, which is about a 5,000-member congregation, multi-staff. The way that program works is if you were to kind of use the analogy of a medical residency, so that over the course of 2 years, you really kind of rotate through some of the major areas of ministry: Christian education, worship, evangelism, mission, really kind of immersing yourselves in those for several months at a time, as a way of learning kind of the ins and outs of those particular areas of ministry. And in addition to that, because we were in a multi-staff setting, really being able to work with pastors, each of whom had very different styles and approaches to ministry, and so out of that, being able to kind of discover, you know, what my own style and voice is. One of the things that I really learned about myself in that time was that I knew going into it that long term my interest and passion would be in a multicultural setting. But I was also I came out of that, even though I loved being in a large church at that time, I really felt called more to small and medium-sized church ministry. Wanted to kind of step into a congregation that maybe was reimagining itself, kind of redeveloping and in a process of transformation. So intentionally kind of sought those kind of congregations out when I finished my time in Indianapolis. And so that's largely how I ended up in Chicago. Being a Southerner, both my wife and I are from the South, and we weren't looking to come to Chicago after that. But, you know, as we do believe, especially in our Reformed tradition, in the providence of God, I think, you know, this is certainly once that conversation began, it became clear that this is where I was called at this time.
Let me invite listeners to join this conversation with Reverend Reggie Weaver from the First Presbyterian Church of Chicago. We're talking to him by phone today, live on Keeping the Faith. And if you'd like to join us, do give us a call. In the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area, you may punch in 333-9455. That's within the 217 area code. If you're listening long distance, perhaps even online, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. So long distance, a toll-free number, 800-222-WILL, locally 333-WILL. And if you missed part of this program, you can, of course, hear it when it's put into our archives. You can go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Leave the G off of keeping, and you can find all of our prior programs there for you to listen to at your convenience. Reggie, you mentioned your spouse, so where did you meet her?
I met her, let's see, where do we actually meet? Because we like to tell the whole story. We actually did meet in Indianapolis, Indiana, but we met there 10 years ago, or over 10 years ago now. She and I both were very involved in youth and young adult ministry, both as youth and then when we got into college in other leadership roles. And there was a conference, a youth and young adult conference happening there over the 99-2000 New Year's holiday. Huh. And so we met there, and that was, you know, literally we just met. We had mutual friends, and that kind of was the beginning of a friendship. She and I worked together a couple summers after that at Montreat Conference Center out in North Carolina and in western North Carolina, the Asheville area. Became even better friends there, and we started dating in seminary. She and I both ended up at the same seminary together. So,
is she a pastor as well?
She is also a pastor, and her real passion in ministry is hospital chaplaincy, and particularly with children and families. And so, she is working part-time here at the Laurie Children's Hospital downtown, formerly Children's Memorial Hospital, which used to be on Lincoln Park. It's recently moved to downtown. And in addition to that, she's been doing some writing, particularly related to some of the joys and the challenges that young female clergy face in ministry.
Tell us the title of that new book of hers that's just out.
The title of her book is Bless Her Heart. We are, you know, so again, a reference to our Southernism, but it's Bless Her Heart, The Life of a Young Female Clergy Person.
And it's published by Chalice.
By Chalice Press.
Yeah. I was able to order that, and I've read one chapter and really, really am enjoying it.
Yeah.
Maybe we can have her on as a guest next year sometime and talk about her book.
Okay.
Reggie, when you came to First Pres Chicago, and as you say, it's a smaller church now than at its height in terms of membership and in terms of budget, there were many struggles you faced, but there was also a lot of programs going on in spite of the fact that the people there were not there in great numbers. Tell us about some of those programs that excited you and wanted you to choose to go to that particular congregation out of your experience at sort of that residency at Second Pres Chicago or okay. Indianapolis.
Okay. Well, I talked some about some of the long-term programs that have been happening for, you know, 30 or 40 years or so, and one you actually made reference to earlier is our food program. For many years, one of the ways that we have engaged the needs of the community is through a weekly soup kitchen and food pantry. And on Tuesdays, Tuesday afternoons we provide a hot lunch for. It's really open to anyone. I think over time those kind of programs did develop an identity, and so most of the folks who tend to come, we have lots of homeless folks, some who are just some who are very recently out of work, and you know, just people who are facing financial difficulties for various reasons. On Thursdays, we have a food pantry. A lot of our food comes primarily from the Greater Chicago Food Depository, but we're also supplementing that in some ways with our community gardens that you referred to as well. So those are some things that the church has had a long-time commitment to. When I arrived, the church, our session had just begun a partnership with the University of Chicago called the Woodlawn Collaborative, and it was at the time a pilot program where essentially the university was covering the costs and expenses of utilizing space in our room, space in our building, so that some of their student groups as well as some local nonprofits here in the Woodlawn community would be able to use those spaces for various types of programming. And that was, I think, very beneficial, particularly for some of the nonprofits in Woodlawn who themselves would not have been able to afford a space here or elsewhere. Part of the vision for that was also recognizing some of the tensions between the Woodlawn and Hyde Park communities. We are just, in terms of our communities, we are divided by 61st Street. So our church is just three blocks south of the Hyde Park community, and I think there have been some historic tensions between those communities, and so there has been an effort of late to really mend some of those relationships, and the Woodlawn Collaborative was a way to do that. As I said, that was a pilot program. It lasted about 2 years, and as a formal program, it no longer exists. But out of that, some of the groups that were a part of that have remained here in the building, and then the church has adopted them really as part of our ministry and thought about ways to address some of the other needs around funding. One of the programs that meets here regularly is an exercise class for senior citizens. It meets here twice a week. They average 20 to 30 folks. It's a class called Seniors Helping Seniors. And as it sounds, it's an exercise class. They do basic calisthenics, chair aerobics. It's directed by Leanne Fain, who is a registered nurse and also a renowned gospel singer herself. And it's a group of primarily older women who come together, and it serves the need not only of really giving them physical exercise, but a lot of the folks who come to that program are women who are widowed, who maybe have never been married, whose family doesn't really live close by. So it's also really kind of served as a social network for them. And so we've been proud to really be able to take that on and provide that space for that group. And as it happens, those kinds of partnerships and relationships really have helped us as we have gone through a process of rethinking and really redefining what our sense of mission really is right now. It so happens that as we were having those conversations, the church really landed that in a place where we really felt called to address various issues of health, healing, and wholeness in our community. Some of that, again, is consistent with the work we've done around food programming, but the fact that we had this exercise class, which was really kind of coincidental, fit very much with our sense of mission as well. And so they've kind of helped us to really think about the fact that even though we are a small congregation and we do have a strong sense of mission, while we may not be able to do all of those things on our own, we can really do that in partnership, and those types of programs have really helped us to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about the relationship with the University of Chicago. As you mentioned, over the decades, there's been tension between the Woodlawn community and people in Hyde Park. Often it's been seen as a white-black kind of antagonism. On the other hand, the university seems to be trying to be more open now, the University of Chicago, to working collaboratively with folks in Woodlawn. I I had a tour of one of their new buildings in Hyde Park last spring, and they seem to be trying to open some of their spaces to programs of people in the broader neighborhood.
I think that's accurate, so the best I can say is that seems to be the case, and from what I've seen here, that I think you're right. And with that said, there's still kind of old habits and old suspicions, really, really die hard. So there's still a bit of skepticism, I think, within the Woodlawn community about what's happening there. But I do think that from what I've seen, the university is really signaling that they're trying to be a partner in the redevelopment and revitalization of our community.
When you came there as pastor, you've been there 3 years now?
Right.
Did I understand that right? What were the immediate challenges that you faced? Here you are as the first African-American sole pastor, senior pastor there at the congregation. I understand back early in the early 60s there was two co-pastors, one white and one black, but
right.
I believe I'm right in saying you're the first African-American who's been the solo pastor there.
Right.
What challenges did that cause, since you have some long-term members who are Caucasian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, add to that the fact that I came in October 2009, which, and to the city of Chicago, so 2009 was the year that Barack Obama was inaugurated as well. And so, I think there was within the culture, and especially within Chicago, still that kind of sense of, hope and change, and in some ways race factored into that. So I think that I kind of felt that in a way when I came. In particular, it was clear to me that the congregation, and that's of members of any race within the congregation, I think there was a genuine desire to be a multicultural congregation. I felt two things.
And in the Presbyterian system, you were called by the congregation with the approval of the higher judicatory.
Exactly.
You weren't just sent there by a bishop.
Right, right. So this was, it was by vote of the congregation. And so a couple things were clear. First of all, multicultural ministry is very, very difficult in any setting. I think now for our church, we've been compared to most Presbyterian congregations, because we are a denomination that even to this day remains 95% or so Caucasian. And so especially for a church to take the stance we did in the 1950s of becoming an integrated church, that was pretty exceptional for congregations. But that said, being multicultural is not simply about having the presence of people of various races. There's kind of hard work that you have to do, where you really work hard to be sure that the respective cultures and points of view of various people are really honored in the way you do worship, and also in the way that our communal life is shaped together. So when I came, there were a couple things I began to realize in some particularly one-on-one conversations with members of various races, but especially with some of the longtime African-American members, that I think there was almost an assumption that because I am African-American, that I was going to come in and really kind of turn this into what we tend to think of as a black church. And I think that assumption, one, because I'm African-American, but also because looking at the reality of our community being a predominantly African-American community, I think that was a natural assumption. It was also, but in the course of those conversations, what I also learned is that some of our African-American members had been here for a long time and really were committed to this church because the church had been committed to the community at large, but were feeling that as far as the multiculturalism, we weren't doing a very good job of that. I think there's grace in that, and so, but it was my suspicions about that were confirmed, basically, just because to be a multicultural church is very difficult. I did not perceive any resistance or hesitation from white members about my leadership here. But I do think that anytime you a person or a group has been historically the dominant in the dominant role within any organization, and especially add to that the layers of race and the dynamics that come with that here in the United States, it takes some learning about what it means to really have a person of a different race as your pastor and leader. And so I think that's a journey that we've all taken together. Fortunately,
they must be very proud of you for the acclaim you've received as a preacher, even nationally, being on the day one Protestant program of selected as a preacher not just once but several times already in your relatively young career.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, and I think there's pride, but it's also part of what this congregation has really appreciated about those opportunities is that when I came, one thing this church really did want to do is really reengage the ministry and the work of the larger church. We had gotten to a point where we were very kind of insular and focused on our own kind of in-house concerns, and so this was a church that was really hungering to kind of reconnect, and so. Both the work I've done on day one and in other roles has been a way that we've done that. So the church is happy to really feel a sense of its connection to a greater denomination.
And let me just follow up a little bit on that. For listeners who would like to hear Reverend Reggie Weaver, some of his marvelous sermons, you can do that online. You can go to the church website. Tell us what that is, Reggie.
The church website is, this is all spelled out, First Pres Chicago, FirstPres Chicago.org. And regarding some of the other sermons that you named on day one, you can go to dayone.org, dayone.org.
Day and then numeral1.org. Right. Very easy to find, very easy to remember. You can go there and then punch in Reggie Weaver, and you'll find the times that he's offered sermons for the national radio audience through Day One.
Yes.
Dayone.org or FirstPresChicago.org. You can also find on the church websites descriptions of ministries and opportunities. And, of course, we have listeners in Chicago online, and some times of the year we also have broadcast can be heard there if you have a very good radio or perhaps you're in your car. But we're heard throughout central Illinois and western Indiana by broadcast. And again, let me repeat, the archive programs here can be found at will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Reggie Weaver, who's pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Chicago, originally from Mobile, Alabama, graduate of Rhodes College and Columbia Seminary, was an intern at the Second Presbyterian Church in Indiana, Indianapolis, a 5,000-member church, which is predominantly white, as I remember. Is that still the case, Reggie?
That is still the case. That's still the case.
And had there been other African-Americans on staff before?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think there had been on the pastoral staff, but in some of the other support staff roles, yes. Yeah.
And that Lilly Foundation program, that church has been sponsoring for a number of years, and has been some wonderful people have come through that program, and I know you were pleased to be selected to be part of that.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about your preaching. I mentioned how impressed I was with having heard several of your sermons online. Your congregation currently has decided to use a slightly different lectionary. Tell us about that.
Yes, we are. So first of all, when I came, I was, when I first arrived, I was never really wedded to any one lectionary. I think the first year, well, not the first year, but at least the first couple months, partly as just a way of introducing myself and who I am and kind of where I am theologically. I was really just trying to give the congregation a sense of what that was. And so that meant that I wasn't necessarily sticking to one particular lectionary. And then we went through a process where, as we were beginning to discern the next steps for us in terms of our mission, I used the preaching and worship time as a way to kind of help us to answer some of those questions. And so kind of moved to a type of sermon, preaching that was more topical or thematic, just kind of based on where we were moving as a congregation. And so it's really just been within the past year that I've returned to any kind of lectionary. And one, there's a new lectionary that is being developed by some teachers at Luther Seminary in Minnesota called the Narrative Lectionary. Most Presbyterians, and not just Presbyterians, but many mainline denominations use what's called the Revised Common Lectionary.
Methodist, Lutheran.
Right.
Sure.
But the Narrative Lectionary is being designed as a way of doing two things. First of all, just recognizing that we're at a point, I think, in the church where even for longtime church members, there is a need to just kind of go back and relearn the narrative arc of the story. You know, so from Genesis through the end of the New Testament, recognizing the way they describe it through at Luther is looking at the kind of overall sweep of salvation history and the way God has done that from one end of the Bible to the other. The other is also addressing as many congregations are starting to get an increasing number of people who are previously unchurched and maybe don't have any kind of familiarity with the Bible, wanting to, in some ways, through the worship time, provide from week to week kind of a sampling of the various books and the story. So the way it is structured is that it's a 9-month cycle. Starts in September, ends with Pentecost, and the fall and early winter is completely focused on the Old Testament. You get one assigned passage per week, and it moves from Genesis to Exodus, all the way up. We're now getting into the prophets as we move into Advent. It's been helpful, I think, in this context, both, as I said, as a way of kind of refreshing some of the longtime members as far as the narrative arc. It's also really helped to really give a clearer sense of the history and kind of what's behind all of these wonderful books. One of the things our congregation has really enjoyed learning is just the way different types of genres work throughout the scriptures, recognizing that not everything we read is the same type of story, and so talking about the way the type of literature really affects the interpretation of the sermon and the passage. So we're doing that, and then the way that lectionary is structured then is that in the late winter and into the spring, you're focusing on one of the Gospels, and so I believe we'll be moving into Luke starting around Christmas time, and then finally into the Epistles of Paul. So it's been fun to engage that and really hear a different type of questioning from the congregation in conversations after.
In terms of education programs, I know First Presbyterian Church of Chicago over the years has had outstanding programs for the youth in the community, for children, Head Start programs, programs for teenagers. At one point, you had pastors that were even working with some of the youth gangs in the area, trying to turn some of those activities to something more productive in the community.
Right.
You have such a rich history there. And you yourself are a relatively young man, as you've described your time and your interest in young adult ministry, youth ministry. What are some of the things you're thinking of trying now that you've become a bit more established in the church now in your third year as pastor there?
We are still really struggling with that and wrestling with that. And part of that is the reality of the fact that though I do have a strong interest and background in youth ministry, I'm also the solo pastor here. So, you know, there's already a lot that comes with that. And so in terms of my personal ability to be able to develop some things, you know, that's it's been difficult to be able to find the time for that. But we have, especially of late, we've had an increase in particularly young families moving in, and as I have conversations and really kind of help people to discover their gifts and interests, we've got some folks who've really identified a passion for youth ministry. So. You know, I think for us, what that's going to look like is initially starting small. We've got a handful at this point of youth who are in that middle school, high school age range who are coming. We'll begin soon, pretty soon, starting a small group for them just to have some sort of core in terms of a faith community. But in addition to that, some of the other ways that we are engaging youth in our community, as I was saying earlier, is through partnership with other organizations. One of the ways that is happening is that there's an organization called ACE, Athletes Committed to Education, which is whose mission is to introduce or really, I guess more appropriately, reintroduce what has become non-traditional sports here in the south side of Chicago. There's lots of opportunities for basketball and football, but they're really trying to reintroduce things like tennis, lacrosse, soccer. And so right now their focus is tennis, and they are using one of the spaces in our building. We actually have a gymnasium on our third floor, which is a basketball gym, but they're using it during the winter months because one of the challenges on the south side is if you want to play tennis, there aren't a lot of indoor spaces to do that. And so during the winter months, they use our space. And that's focused on middle school and high school children. So that program each week, probably 30 or 40 middle school and high school students coming through our doors. And so we are also taking that opportunity to really engage them and their families as we as a congregation really think about how we can more effectively address the needs of youth.
Reverend Weaver, we're about 20 minutes to the end of our program. I need to take a short break.
That's okay.
And we're going to hear about some information about a upcoming Focus program.
Okay.
Next time on Focus, we'll talk about obsessive-compulsive disorder and other related anxiety disorders with licensed clinical professional counselor Shayla Parker. We'll discuss how such disorders manifest themselves, what treatment options are available, and whether in today's society there is still a stigma associated with anxiety disorders. I'm Craig Cohen, the host of the show. Hope you can join us for Focus Monday morning at 10 on listener-supported public radio, WILL AM 580.
That's tomorrow morning on Focus with Craig Cohen at 10 a.m. here on WILL. I'm Steve Shoemaker. We're on Keeping the Faith here on Sunday night with our guest, Reggie Weaver. Let me give the phone numbers again. People may have heard enough of my questions and want to ask some of their own. 333-9455 in the area code 217. That's 333-WILL. If it's long distance, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. Let me just mention while we're taking a short break that next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be continuing this theme of serving a multicultural church, an interracial church, with a pastor from Philadelphia by phone, pastor of the Overbrook Church there in Philadelphia, Reverend Wallace Buber, B-U-B-E-R. Well, I'll have to ask him if he's any relation to the famous Martin Buber, Jewish scholar, theologian. The following week, November 25, because I'll be traveling with the Thanksgiving holiday, we're going to play an archive program from earlier this year, an interview with Dr. Ron Sider, theologian, founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. His most recent book is called Fixing the U.S. Moral Deficit. Fascinating book. And it was a fascinating interview. So we'll be replaying that interview from last June on November 25th here on Keeping the Faith. Then in December, Laura Frericks will be our guest on Sunday, December 2nd. She's the director of the University of Illinois Research Park. And we'll be talking with her about the value of shared knowledge. December 9, we'll be talking with some young adults who've been in voluntary service through their religious affiliations. Later in December, Sam Smith will be our guest on the Sunday right before Christmas, the 23rd. He's Krannert Center for the Performing Arts Community Engagement Officer, and so we'll be talking with Sam Smith on December 23rd. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith, and hope you can hear them when they're broadcast and perhaps join the conversation by phone, or if not, listen on your various electronic devices at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith and leave the G off of keeping. We're very, very informal on this program. Well, back to our guest today, Reggie Weaver. Reggie, you mentioned growing up in a Black Baptist church and about some of the expectations when you came to First Pres of Chicago that you might be sort of reverting to your roots in some ways. Are there temptations to do that, the enthusiasm of the Black church, the passion, the excitement? That's hard to leave behind.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't even use the word temptation. I think that, and again, I think one of the realities of being in a multicultural setting is that you also realize the value of that kind of background. So I didn't mean to communicate that, I'm leaving that behind in any way. But I'm still very much informed and shaped by that experience. Nothing else. I probably learned more about Scripture and the Bible from that tradition. Even in preaching, not every week, but I think that most weeks, the way I approach preaching, at least the preparation, is very much informed by those roots as well. I don't see it as a temptation by any means, but I think it's part of who I am and my identity, and so it's been a valuable part of the way I do ministry in this church.
What are some of the strengths of the congregation you found when you arrived?
It is a very, very tenacious congregation. I think that this is a church that, when I arrived, had been at least in numerical decline for about 20 or so years.
Or maybe 50.
It kind of depends on when you start the count, which is interesting because when it was, if you look at some of the early session minutes, even though it had been a very progressive, it was a very progressive church. When the church made the decision to become an integrated church, they began to lose members, and it wasn't as obvious at that time because they were gaining some of those members back in African-American members. But you're right, as is the case really with a lot of mainline denominations, that trend probably began in the 50s, but became more obvious really 20 or so years ago. So with that, what I came to, a lot of times you would come and there's just there could be a real sense of defeat about that, but this was a congregation that had a lot of optimism, very, very talented, hardworking congregation. The congregation is also has a strong sense of its own history, but also I think larger history both in the Chicago and in our nation. And so that becomes a gift because we look at that and can think about what lessons we can learn for good and bad about things that have happened. So as we think about moving forward, learning from the past. Having said that, I think one of the temptations then is that you get stuck in history. So we've worked hard as well to celebrate our past, but also recognize that we're not here to continue to be who we were 100 or even 50 or even 20 years ago.
But with your congregation having a 50-year history as an interracial church, a very consciously chosen,
right,
position as an interracial, multicultural church. What do you have to share with the larger culture, which is now, we've heard this last week since the election results, our country is becoming very multicultural.
Right.
What have you learned in the last 50 years that you can share helpfully with the larger culture?
Yeah, well, I think, again, one thing is that to be really, truly, authentically multicultural, it's difficult. It is difficult work, and I don't say that in a despairing way. I think it's just the reality. Anytime you are bringing, trying to do it in an authentic way, bringing people from different backgrounds in a way that feels unified and in a way that really honors everyone, it's hard to do because it means that regardless of race, ethnicity, class, there's a kind of compromise that has to happen on all of our parts in order for that experiment to work. So one thing I would share, I think, that this church from the last 50 years is just kind of hang in there, can continue to do it.
Is white racism the biggest barrier?
It's a barrier. It's not the biggest barrier. I say that in part because regardless of race, we are all capable of our own prejudice. I've got it. You've got it. So I think the biggest barrier really is for each individual to acknowledge that about themselves, regardless of race. Once you acknowledge that, then there's at least an opening to begin to move forward. I think another big barrier is for all sides just fear, fear of the other. Even as part of what our congregation tried to do over the past 50 years with becoming a multicultural church is really try to reflect what we really see in scriptures as the diversity of the body of Christ. But that also comes with a certain level of, or certain lack of knowledge, or just a sense in which the other is just unknown and kind of foreign to us. And so it can be scary to really engage that.
It's certainly been truly said that in America, the most segregated hour is still the hour on Sunday morning when people are in worship.
Right, right.
Your congregation is an example that it doesn't have to be that way. And you say people are hopeful there, but do you see much change around you in the suburbs, for example, of Chicago?
Well, I mean, the short answer is no, but also, we have been and are kind of where we are because of the demographics of where our community is. I wonder had our community not changed, if we would have made that intentional step.
Sure.
My sense from the history of the church is that this always would have been a congregation that sought and tried to be welcoming to anyone. But in a way, we had to. It was the reality of where we were as a congregation. Still currently in some of the suburbs in Chicago and other places, they haven't had to face that reality. So I guess you're right. In a way that the answer there is no. But I can say through conversations with colleagues and some of the partnerships that we have developed with some of our suburban partners, I think that there is a desire to be a more diverse congregation. I think every congregation is really wrestling with how you do that authentically.
The music that ended All Things Considered weekends, All Things Considered, just before our program began, there was a tenor sax player, Miguel Signon, was playing a tune called Forgiveness. And our theme music is a tenor sax, John Ellis, playing our theme music, which is a tune that he wrote called Grace. Where do forgiveness and grace fit in a multicultural congregation?
They are critical. I think that when you're in a multicultural setting, and especially for our particular makeup being white and black, and given the history of what that has meant, especially in this nation, we could not be together, and especially have been together for so long without forgiveness. And I think for us, where grace has come in, is that it is a constant reminder to us that that grace does not belong to us alone. And so, in those times when we are, feeling as if we are wanting to kind of draw lines and build walls because of race, class, whatever the issues are, we're having to constantly go back and reexamine that this is a gift that's been given to us to share. And so, it doesn't allow us to just kind of rest on our laurels and kind of plant our heels and just be stuck where we are. It's for all.
What time are your services?
Services are every Sunday at 11 a.m., and we have a Bible study every Thursday at 6:30 p.m.
And again, the address of the church is 6400 South Kimbark. Corner of Kimbark and 64th Street in Chicago. It's outside of Chicago in the Woodlawn area. Well, Reggie Weaver, we're very happy to have had you as a guest today by phone. Thank you for taking time out of your very busy life as a solo pastor of that large building and active congregation. Appreciate very much your being on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you for the opportunity.
My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith. Let me remind you that if you'd like to learn more about Reverend Reggie Weaver, you can hear his sermons by going to the church website, firstpreschicago.org, or since he's been featured as one of the sterling preachers of our day on the national radio syndicated program Day One, you can go to dayone.org. That's day1.org. Punch in Reggie Weaver, REGGIEWEAVER, to hear some of his exceptionally good sermons. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, we continue our little mini-series here on serving multicultural churches and interracial churches. We'll be talking with a pastor in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, pastor of the Overbrook Church there, Reverend Wallace Buber, B-U-B-E-R. That's November 18, 2012, here on Keeping the Faith. On November 25th, I'll be traveling, and so we will have an archive program, an excellent program from last June 24th. Ron Sider is a theologian, a writer, an editor, a founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. His most recent book that came out just this year is called Fixing the U.S. Moral Deficit. And he talks about how that's necessary before we can begin thinking really seriously about fixing the financial deficit. But he talks a lot about finances in that book, national finances, in a very helpful way. So that's Sunday evening at 5 Central Time, November 25, here on Keeping the Faith. And then in December, we're excited to have Laura Frericks will be our guest on December 2nd. She'll be talking about the value of shared knowledge. Laura Frericks is the director of the University of Illinois Research Park. On December 9th, we'll be talking with young adults who have been volunteering in service in our country, sponsored by their religious faith. Sam Smith will be our guest December 23rd. He's the community engagement officer for Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Hope you'll tune in on Sunday night here at 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580.